This is Talkish. I am Hallie Kester Jane. Welcome to the show. The Hallie Kester Jane Show is always available at HallieKesterJane.com. Now, let's get to it. On episode 305, we're taking a trip east when joining me at my table is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and renowned military historian, Max Boot, the author of The Road Not Taken, Edward Lansdale and the American Tragedy in Vietnam. And in our second half hour, the Economist Cuba correspondent and the author of Leftover in China, The Women Shaping the World's Next Superpower, Roseanne Lake. Let's get to it. We begin with Max Boot, a regular contributor to MSNBC, The New York Times, Foreign Policy, The Los Angeles Times, and other publications. The author of Savage Wars of Peace and the New York Times bestseller Invisible Armies, Boot's latest work, his contribution to the 50-year debate over why the Vietnam War went so wrong, is The Road Not Taken, Edward Lansdale and the American Tragedy in Vietnam, a biography of profound historical consequence, rescuing the legendary CIA operative Lansdale from historical disgrace. Might Vietnam have been different had we only listened to Edward Lansdale? After extensive research, including Boot's access to never-before-seen documents, love letters, and dozens of interviews, the historian has recast this cautionary American story, tracking the daring rise and utter fall of the roguish T.E. Lawrence of Asia, of Dien Bien Phu, to the humiliating American evacuation in 1975. It's time for Talkish, Let's Talk, with historian and author of The Road Not Taken, Max Boot. So nice to have you here. A fascinating book, wonderful read, daring conclusions, Max.
Thank you so much.
You're very, very welcome. Let's start with a brief bio of Lansdale. So the audience has some sense of, an overall sense of who this guy was, because I don't know that a lot of people do know him, and he's so fascinating. And just give us a little bit, you know, a little, before we get into the weeds of who this guy was.
Well, Ed Lansdale was one of the most storied covert operatives in the history of the CIA. He was somebody who helped to put down a communist insurgency in the Philippines in the early 1950s, and then in 1954 went to Saigon and helped to create the new state of South Vietnam. Later on, he was involved in running Operation Mongoose, the unsuccessful effort to overthrow Fidel Castro, and he became an internal critic of U.S. policy towards Vietnam because although he believed in helping South Vietnam, he was very much opposed to the Kennedy administration overthrowing his friend Ngo Dinh Diem in 1973, and later he was opposed to the massive war effort that the Johnson administration launched with bombing of North Vietnam and half a million U.S. troops in the South. Ed Lansdale consistently said that wasn't going to work. You could not bomb this revolution into oblivion. You had to offer a better alternative to the people of South Vietnam. In other words, in the hackneyed phrase, hearts and minds. And sadly, he was ignored. And so, you know, I tell his story. He became a legend, said to be the model for the quiet American and the ugly American. But I try to tell his story as it really happened, beyond the myths, beyond the legends, to reveal the real man.
Did you go into writing The Road Not Taken wanting to upend the current talking points in which all roads lead to Vietnam being America's epic fail? Or what were you thinking? What was the thesis that you went into this with?
Well, the thesis was really that I was fascinated by this character, Edward Lansdale. And, you know, I wanted to tell his stories that had not been told before. I wrote about him a little bit in my last book, Invisible Armies, which was a history of guerrilla warfare down through the ages. And, you know, as my editor and I at Norton were talking about what I should do next, he suggested doing a full-blown examination of Ed Lansdale. And initially, I was skeptical because I thought, well, I'd already written about him some. But he was dead right because I uncovered a vast amount of new material, including the love letters that he wrote to this Filipino woman, Pat Kelly, who was his longtime mistress and eventually his second wife, and then also the letters that he was writing often simultaneously to his first wife, Helen. And so I'm the first person after Ed Lansdale himself to have read both sets of correspondence. And in addition, there's a lot of newly declassified papers I was able to draw on. And so I'm able to present the Lansdale story in a way that it has not been presented before.
He is fascinating. Oh my gosh! Really, and I mean, first of all, he's bigger than life. I mean, I know they called him the American T.E. Lawrence. To those who don't know who T.E. Lawrence and more familiar Lawrence of Arabia, you know, others describe him as enigmatic and consternating. I just think do they even make people like that anymore?
I mean, no, he was one of a kind. He was a tremendous character. There were so many adventures he was involved in, and so many paradoxes to the man too, because among them was the fact that he was supremely skilled in winning over foreign leaders like Ramon Magsaysay in the Philippines and Odin's Yem in South Vietnam, but he often alienated his own leaders in the U.S. government, including Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, and that ultimately limited his effectiveness because he made so many bureaucratic enemies that at the end of the day, he had trouble getting anyone in the Johnson administration to listen to him in the 1960s, even though what he had to say has, I think, been vindicated by history.
Absolutely. But I think it is interesting because at that time there were a lot of names, you know, you could throw a whole bunch out, and all of them seemed to be in one way or another bigger than life. It's not like that today. We just don't have those kind of characters anymore. And whether you agreed with their politics or their whole thinking on Nam or anything, you know, there they were, you know, LBJ. Big and awesome as the Texas Plains, JFK, the romantic hero. I mean, there have been many attempts to divine this guy Lansdale, and he confounds people. What did you think most of all that people miss about this guy that made him so fascinating and so dynamic and so smart?
Well, I think one of the important things that people miss is that he was a very astute student of the societies in which he found himself, the Philippines and in Vietnam, yet he kind of came across as a hayseed, and this was something that was pointed out to me by Dan Ellsberg, the Pentagon Papers leaker who got his start working for Lansdale in Vietnam in 1965. And Ellsberg pointed out to me that, you know, Lansdale often came across as this very simplistic American, rah-rah Constitution Declaration of Independence, and that caused correspondents and others often to dismiss him as for being so supposedly unsophisticated. But Ellsberg pointed out that behind closed doors, Lansdale was actually very sophisticated in his view, very aware of the nuances, and he wasn't drinking the moonshine. I mean, he understood that the war effort in Vietnam was failing from a very early point. And so there was a real disparity between the public kind of simplistic Ed Lansdale self and the private, much more sophisticated and often much more negative perceptions that he had of what was going on.
Tell us about his childhood a little bit. I mean, how did he become who he became? There's a path there. That gets you to the kind of thinking that this guy got to. Who was he as a boy to and how he went from one part of his life to A to B to C to D to get to where he got so powerful?
Well, he was a middle-class kid. He was not to the manor born. He did not go to an Ivy League school or work on Wall Street like so many of the shapers of post-war American foreign policy. His dad was an automotive executive, and often his companies went bankrupt. Sometimes they did well. Up and down childhood, he spent most of his early years in California, in L.A. specifically, and he became kind of a quintessential Californian, very laid back, very informal, hated protocol, hated bureaucracy, hated regimentation, didn't like to wear a necktie. He was kind of a proto-Silicon Valley guy years before Silicon Valley came into existence. He was an indifferent student, and his life should give hope to see students everywhere. He went to UCLA and dropped out short of graduation in the early 30s at the height of the Great Depression, moved to New York hoping to become a New Yorker writer or cartoonist, never made it, and instead went into advertising and had a flourishing advertising career in LA and San Francisco in the 1930s. And then World War II came along, the attack on Pearl Harbor. He couldn't quite enlist in the Army initially because he was too old and had some medical issues. So he went into the OSS, America's first civilian intelligence agency. He spent the war years stateside interviewing travelers about these strange and wondrous places where Allied troops would shortly be landing from the North Africa to the Pacific. And then towards the end of World War II, he transferred into the Army. And in the fall of 1945, as the war was ending and millions of GIs were coming home, he shipped abroad on his first permanent overseas assignment in the Philippines. And that became the making of the Lansdale legend, because his first big success would be masterminding the defeat of the Hook Rebellion, this communist insurgency in the Philippines.
The word quagmire. You can't say the word Vietnam and not say the word quagmire, right? I mean, you know, they go hand in hand.
Yes, kind of like peanut butter and jelly.
And, you know, it's kind of unfortunate. It's a war that went on seemingly forever. Different players, same results, the type of war we so now fear, right?
Yes.
In fact, we've been living in fear of war since the fall of Saigon. You don't blame. I shouldn't say you. I'll just say that quagmire is, a lot of it is often given to Lansdale. That has been part of his legacy. Where are you on that?
Well, I certainly wouldn't blame him for the quagmire that Vietnam became. I mean, at some meta level, you can say that maybe he was responsible because he did try to create the state of South Vietnam. But, you know, the U.S. was going to be committed to a non-communist alternative in South Vietnam no matter what. The question was how that commitment would manifest itself. And Lansdale always wanted to do it in the most modest terms possible with the smallest possible American footprint. He never wanted to see 500,000 troops in Vietnam. And the fact that they showed up there was in disregard of all the best advice that he had to offer. And what I suggest in the book is that a real turning point was the Diem coup in November of 1963, because Lansdale warned against overthrowing Diem. He warned that Diem was the least bad alternative possible and that South Vietnam would be destabilized if he was overthrown. The Kennedy administration didn't listen to him. They overthrew Diem, and the results were every bit as bad as he said. And not only was South Vietnam destabilized and North Vietnam stepped up its aggression, but as the Pentagon Papers later noted, this was the event that really Americanized the war, because having helped to overthrow South Vietnam's lawful government, we then took ownership of South Vietnam. And it was a pretty short road from there to this massive and doomed American military commitment.
So I'm going to tell you a story. I remember some years ago when I was working on a story on the first American diplomat to be taken hostage by terrorists and freed back in Guatemala. It was in the early 70s. I did an interview with Brian Jenkins. I don't know if you know Brian from the RAND Corporation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
So Brian was terrific. I mean, this was I was getting into new territory in those days when I was writing this story. Brian understood the nature of that war. He was a vet himself. And he wrote papers on the future of war. And mostly what he wrote at the time was ignored. I met him, I guess, we're going back to the 80s now. And even at that point, you know, he was trying to say, it's changing, it's going to change, this isn't... But I want to talk to you about this. He talked about terrorism. He foresaw everything that is happening right now. But I want to bring up the term counterinsurgency. And now Lansdale had his own ideas about counterinsurgencies. He had beliefs different than was popular back in the day. And I think we have to talk about that. You'll see where I'm going. But can we just address counterinsurgency?
Well, Lansdale was a pioneer in counterinsurgency. I mean, much of what we think of as counterinsurgency today were ideas that he invented and implemented in the early 1950s in the Philippines at a time when the word counterinsurgency did not yet exist. I mean, the key insight that he had was that the way you beat insurgents is not by using more force, but using less force. And he counseled the Philippine army to stop bombarding villages, stop killing civilians, because he told them this was going to create more enemies than they eliminated by alienating all these civilians. And his doctrine was that the army should hug the people close. They should treat the army should treat the people as brothers, people to be protected. And once the people were secure with the army and trusted the army, then they would rat out the insurgents in their midst. And that's essentially the formula for counterinsurgency success. That's been implemented in many other places, from Northern Ireland to Iraq during the surge in 2008, to more recently in Colombia.
So this guy is an independent thinker, right?
Very much so, yeah. Very much a maverick and a troublemaker in many ways. Very anti-bureaucratic.
My kind of guy. And it's unusual, or it is usual that within the institutions and bureaucracies of America, the independent thinkers, right?
Yes.
Have a really hard time.
Yeah, well, it's rare that an independent thinker would rise as far as Lansdale, who eventually retired as a two-star general.
Why do you think he was able to navigate so well?
Well, he wasn't able to navigate the U.S. government so well, but he had tremendous success in the early 1950s and mid-50s under the patronage of CIA Director Allen Dulles and his brother John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State. And they allowed him to override a lot of bureaucratic rivals, including local ambassadors with whom he clashed and many others. And so they enabled him to have this tremendous success, which could not be denied. But eventually, the Dulles brothers disappeared from the scene, and Lansdale was left unprotected against his many bureaucratic enemies, including the most important, his own boss, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, in the early 1960s.
So I want to get back to this independent thinkers. Go with me on this, Max, all right?
Yeah, sure.
I bring that up because I want to pivot to President Trump for a minute.
Okay.
All right. You certainly have made no secret of your disagreements with Trump, for the record, nor have I.
Yes.
You and I are on the same page. So assuming that Trump is a thinker And the jury is clearly out on all of that.
Yeah, we'll assume that for the minute. Yep.
All right. But if he is, if he really stands for independent thinking brought to bureaucracy. You know, I was thinking about this morning. Are we his distracted detractors? And Max, notwithstanding his utter immorality, which you and I both know and agree on that, are we maybe missing that maybe Trump is sort of a Lansdale? I'm just going to do this to play, you know, the polar opposite. Or maybe that's how his followers see him. Or maybe that's what they need him to be. And I think there's a lesson here. If you look at Lansdale and then you look at this Trump thing that's happened in this country, maybe there's something there. Am I going out too far on a limb?
Yeah, I don't know that I quite follow you there. I mean, I would actually say that Trump is the anti-Lansdale, because Lansdale believed in engaging people abroad with empathy, friendliness, trust, treating them as equals, not looking down upon them. And that was really the secret of his success in the Philippines and in Vietnam. Whereas, of course, Trump is the opposite in all respects, because he treats the world with hostility, condescension, offensive tweets and statements. He writes off entire continents. He has no use for soft power. If anything, he's practicing unilateral disarmament when it comes to soft power. So I think in most respects, in pretty much every respect, other than being you can say they're both somewhat unconventional, but in all the substantive respects, I would say Trump is very, very different from Edward Lansdale. And we could actually use a good dose of Lansdalean thinking today in the U.S. government.
I totally agree with you, but I think the point is it should be made because the people who are following Trump think they see him as a Lansdale. They see him as an independent thinker. They see him as breaking the rules and going after bureaucracy and doing a new navigation, if you will. And maybe I struggle with trying to understand people who follow this guy, because to me he looks like an absolute idiot, mentally,
yeah,
morally, and in every other way.
Right. Again, I agree with you. And again, very different from Lansdale, who, in spite of this stereotype that he was, you know, simplistic, was actually a sophisticated thinker. And, you know, he was one of the first Americans to read the works of Mao Zedong and to understand what Mao was saying. Whereas, you know, Trump is a guy who's probably never read a book in his life since graduating from college. So, you know, just very, very different.
Totally, totally different. I want to read you something here, okay? It's from a piece in the Washington Post, a piece everyone should read. And by the way, you wrote it. You're talking about Russia meddling in our elections and Trump's refusal to do anything about it. Now, you and I share the opinion that we are in the midst of a war, a cyber war, major consequence. I'll go back to Brian Jenkins, by the way, who said this was all going to be coming in one way or another, a new type of warfare. Anyway, here it is. Here's what you wrote. Just as September 11th made clear that private security could not safeguard the aviation system, so the 2016 Russian attack made clear that social media companies cannot safeguard the electoral system. A greater federal role is needed, yet Trump refuses to even admit that the problem exists. The most benign explanation is that Trump is putting his vanity, he can't have anything taint his glorious victory, above his obligation to protect and defend the Constitution. The more sinister hypothesis is that he has something to hide, and having benefited from Russia's assistance once, hopes for more aid in 2018 and 2020. Either way, we are at war without a commander-in-chief. Ah, Max, how courageous, how astute, how wonderful that you went out on a limb like that. What's the response been?
It's been interesting. There's been a lot of response. I mean, there's been a lot of positive response. I was, you know, on Morning Joe with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski talking about it, and of course they liked it. I've also gotten a lot of, you know, vicious blowback on Twitter from Trump trolls who accused me of being, you know, gasp, a leftist, and you know, a warmonger, you know, suggesting that if I want to defend America against Russian cyber attacks, then I must be in favor of nuclear war with Russia, all sorts of non sequiturs. I've even been, you know, accused of being a Russian propagandist, which kind of leads me to kind of scratch my head in befuddlement, because so somebody who wants to defend against Russian attacks is a Russian propagandist, but somebody who wants to leave us undefended against Russian subversion is putting America first. I mean, this is, you know, kind of Orwellian logic that has taken root in our politics today.
You're one of the smartest people that I know. I have to ask you, I mean, what do you really think is going on with this guy? I mean, seriously, I mean, are you going so far as to say he's been compromised, that he's in collusion? What do you really think?
Well, we just don't know. I mean, that's Bob Mueller's job, is to determine that. I mean, clearly, Trump has some kind of strange relationship with Putin because, you know, Trump is a guy who criticizes pretty much everybody in the world, from Angela Merkel to Oprah Winfrey to Jay-Z, and yet he never has a negative word to say about Vladimir Putin. And in fact, everything he says about Putin is basically admiring. So, you know, the question is, why? Does he just think that Putin is a great guy and an authoritarian to be admired and emulated? Or has he been compromised financially or in other ways? Is there collusion that he's hiding between the Trump campaign and the Russians? I mean, we've already seen some evidence of collusion come into view. But again, I think we are, you know, waiting for Bob Mueller to tell us what the real story is. But you just can't argue with the fact that we already know that we were attacked by Russia. Trump's own national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, said this is an incontrovertible fact. And yet Trump will still not really admit it, and he will not do anything about it. And he's leaving us undefended because his own intelligence chiefs just testified that the Russians are targeting the 2018 election. They're active all the time. They're taking advantage of the Parkland shooting, all this other stuff online that they are trying to foment division in the United States, to undermine us, to elect their favorite candidates, as Trump was in 2016. And Trump won't do anything about it. So it does make you wonder if maybe, you know, he is grateful to Russia for their help in 2016, and if he's counting on further help in 2018 and 2020. I mean, that's not a crazy hypothesis.
Well, here's something else, though, on this, and that is the fact that nobody's doing anything about this. Nobody. And the Republicans sitting on the Hill, they're doing nothing either. They're in with Trump. This is dangerous. Why are people not understanding how dangerous this is?
It's disgraceful. I mean, Republicans have long prided themselves on being the law and order party, the strong national security party, and they've abandoned all those beliefs. Now they're trashing the FBI because it's investigating Donald Trump, and they're refusing to stand up to Russia because Trump seems to have benefited from Russian intervention. So this is disgraceful and shameful, and that's, in a nutshell, that's why I can't be a Republican anymore.
I just what concerns me is that, you know, I want Mueller to get to the bottom of it, and I want him to do it methodically in all of those ways. But I'm thinking every day that goes by, we are in that much more danger, and crazy stuff is happening, and nothing is being done about it. But we could wax eloquent on that story forever and ever. Going back to Vietnam, a host of presidents who made mistakes, generals who did the same, operatives who failed, you know, a country torn in two. Lessons to be learned?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's a lot of lessons from Vietnam. I mean, and especially from Ed Lansdale's experience about the limits of American firepower, that we can, you know, kill individual insurgents, but it's very hard to kill insurgencies just by trying to kill people, and it often backfires. We saw that in Vietnam. We've seen it more recently, the limits of force in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Libya, et cetera, et cetera. Where, you know, our failure to establish a stable political outcome means that a lot of our tactical military success proves very transitory. It doesn't truly achieve our long-term objectives. That's something that Lansdale would have easily predicted and saw happening in the 60s. And in many ways, we failed to learn that lesson today. And so instead of focusing on political action, which is admittedly very difficult and demanding, we kind of tend to still revert to the technological solution, American firepower, where we have this great advantage over the rest of the world. But it doesn't, you know, it doesn't deliver what we want it to. And that's, we're still struggling with those issues that Lansdale saw for himself decades ago in Vietnam.
So his eyes would be rolling today.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the quotes I have in the book is that, you know, he said that Americans have never learned the simplicity of fighting a political war, and I think that remains true. I mean, he decried our tendency towards, you know, trying to solve these complex political problems with sheer firepower and, you know, military approaches, and that remains very much true to this day.
So talk to me about this as we get into closing. Has Americans' foreign policy and home front politics been permanently scarred by Nam? That's the first question.
That's a good question. I mean, it was certainly scarred by Vietnam for quite a while. And remember, after the Gulf War in 1991, President George H.W. Bush said, you know, we've licked Vietnam syndrome once and for all. And that may be true. Then, you know, we blundered into Iraq. And now I would say it's really Iraq syndrome that scars American foreign policy for good or for ill today. But, you know, it's a similar kind of phenomenon, morning after a hangover from a massive war against an insurgency.
The title of your book is The Road Not Taken, Edward Lansdale and the American Tragedy in Vietnam. And the tragedy was?
Well, the tragedy was that we lost 58,000 Americans, had millions of Vietnamese killed in the crossfire, and we still lost. I mean, that was, you know, it was the worst war in American history. And what I suggest in the book is that if we had listened to Ed Lansdale, things might have worked out differently. And I mean, I can't sit here and guarantee that we would have won. If we'd listened to him, we might still have lost, because North Vietnam was going to be a formidable adversary under any circumstances. But at least if we'd still lost, we wouldn't have lost at this catastrophic cost.
I've been speaking with Max Boot. His book is The Road Not Taken, Edward Lansdale and the American Tragedy in Vietnam. For more information on Max Boot and his work, visit his website at maxboot.net. You are listening to Talkish, the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. My guests today are Max Boot, the author of The Road Not Taken, Edward Lansdale, and the American Tragedy in Vietnam, and Roseanne Lake, the author of Leftover in China, The Woman Shaping the World's Next Superpower. Talkish with Hallie Kasser-Jane. Post new podcasts Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern at HallieKasserJane.com and via all your favorite apps. Now, what is it like to be a woman in today's China? How do the lives of Chinese women compare to American women's lives in the 21st century? To coin a phrase, it's complicated. In Leftover in China, The Woman Shaping the World's Next Superpower, journalist Roseanne Lake answers those questions and chronicles the lives of young Chinese women whom she first met during her years working as a television reporter in Beijing. Women are on the move in China, highly educated, acquiring wealth, property, and a measure of independence in record numbers. But in spite of an overwhelmingly large male population, many struggle to find suitable romantic partners. Known as leftovers if they fail to marry by age 25, these women represent a China in which gender roles have not evolved as vigorously as society itself, and where new professional opportunities have made women less willing to compromise their careers or concede to marriage for the sake of it. The result is a mounting social quagmire, a generation of millions in limbo, torn between past and future, whose lives at once seem straight out of a Jane Austen novel, a bevy of mothers hacking their daughters' dating profiles to secure a quick proposal. It's time for Talkish, Let's Talk, with Leftover in China's author, currently The Economist Cuba correspondent, whose work has been featured in Foreign Policy, Time, Atlantic Salon, and Vice, Roseanne Lake.
This is precious. Let me just say that this is such a great read, because I think that what you chose to do was to make it human. You know, a subject that's very important to women. We all should know each other's lives, particularly, you know, those on the other side and the communist whatever. And I love that this is so personal and that this is about real people that we can meet and understand. And so I want to give you kudos for that before we get going. It's even sassy.
Well, and I, yeah, that's right? Me.
So I think that's important. You spent a lot of time over there, obviously. So what got you going? Said, I need to write this book. What got you going, and what was the purpose? Let's just start there.
Sure. I mean, what got me going was my colleagues, right? Sort of as I described with the preface to the book, I was working with a very dynamite population of young Chinese women. They were the producers, they were directors, they were in charge at an international news station in the capital of China. They were bilingual, they had been well educated, and it really kind of threw me that after the first Chinese New Year that I spent in China, they had gone home to their families, and this otherwise very promising, you know, population of young women comes back to the office kind of flustered and glum. And this is because they're not married. And I thought, this is absurd. And you know, they're 23, they're 24. And I noticed a difference in mood in the office. And no one would really tell me what was going on. So I asked the superior, and she was just very frank, you know, like, They're just upset because they're not married. And I'm thinking, you know, what's going on? And so I thought it was outrageous that this was true. And I was upset that they saw it as a blow to their self-esteem, because I thought, you know, you ladies should really be the toast of the nation. China is not a country, you know, despite the women hold up half the sky, it's not really a country that has the best track record for gender relations. And here, you know, I saw a country, or I saw a population of women who could do a lot of good things for the future. And I thought it's just really unfortunate that their self-esteem are taking such a hit as a result of it. And I wanted to help them.
Right.
And of course, you know, I come in with this like New York City moxie, right? Like, ladies, come on. You know. And at first it was like, are you really just being lazy? Like, I know there's a surplus of men in China. There's supposed to be 20 million more men of marriage age than women by 2020. You know, these guys should be popping up around you like dandelions. You should each have 5 suitors. What's going on? And I kind of got blank stares. And I thought, all right, let me dig a little bit further. And as soon as I looked into the geography of the demographic imbalance, things started to make sense. I realized that, you know, despite the surplus of men, the vast majority of these guys were located in rural areas of China, where tradition dictated that parents, if they were going to only be able to have one child, had a boy. And, you know, girls were aborted or disposed of, killed upon birth. And so the vast majority of the surplus men that I thought, you know, these girls should be dating were actually miles away and existed in a completely different socioeconomic, educational universe. And they, you know, ran very little risk of crossing paths with these women because they were just geographically very far away from one another. And on the other hand, it started to become clear that, you know, women born under this time, women who survived the one-child policy, which started in 1979, were born primarily in urban areas where parents were a bit more open-minded and said, you know, okay, we've got a daughter, we'll keep a daughter. We're going to raise her as if she were a son, because what other option do we have? We're going to educate her. We're going to give her all her family resources. If, you know, we have a family business, she'll inherit it one day. We're going to push her to achieve, study, and bring honor to our family as if she were our son. And that's precisely what happened. Many of the women, not all of them were only daughters, but most of them were. They were the products of, you know, China's first generation of only daughters who got unprecedented access to family support and resources and also education. And not just because their families, you know, made that available to them, but because across the board in China's tremendous push to modernize and to grow its economy, it also started spending a much larger part of its GDP on education. And so, you know, as residents of urban areas, they benefited the most from the progress that China saw. And as a result, you know, marriage was no longer the first thing on their minds, which
well,
for
where
country,
does that, you know, I got to cut you in here because I got to say to you,
sure,
this is no different than what happened here. You know, just a different time, a different place. And I think there's a lot of similarity in it. I think I'm a little older than you, and I came of a generation, you know, what, go to work, not get your MRS when you go to college. I mean, you know, my mother, to the day she died, was, you know, horrified. Oh, my God, you have a career. Oh, my God, you've been married how many times? Oh, my God, you're independent. You're running around the world. I mean, I think these generational things are not all that different between the two countries, which made it interesting. But I think it's also good to go back and to see where they are on the spectrum at this point. And it's a great reminder, you know, from whence we have come and whence we can go. I thought that was utterly fascinating. So here's another one, which is women in Chinese society. They've always had a very interesting role in that country. Can you give us a little background on that? I mean, you know, we know geisha, that kind of thing, but there really is, I mean, you know, there have been women who've led revolutions. I mean, talk to me about women in China.
Overall, what I found so fascinating about studying the role of women in China is that there's such a duality to it, right? So if you think about the years or the time of the Forbidden City and concubines, I remember I once met one of my sources was a very superstitious older man. And before he would let me talk to him and ask me any questions, he asked to see my palm. And he read my palm and he decided that in a previous life, I was actually Chinese and that I lived in the Forbidden City. And I thought, oh my, I was a concubine. How exciting. And, you know, if you read about concubines, you understand that these are some of the few women at the time to be exposed to the conversations of men, right? To actually be, to know what's going on in the world. At this time in China, you know, women are, they're stuck to the home. You know, they're not able to do much. China is the country where women had their feet bound for a very long time, right? Yeah, right? And so women didn't have much of a say in the home or in society, in society. And, you know, concubines from a very early time were different. They were educated. They studied poetry and music because part of their job was to entertain the men in the Forbidden City. It wasn't just to, you know, provide to be their paramours. It was also to educate, or not to educate them, but to entertain them. Kind of like, I guess, a geisha would. And so now, I mean, so you have that from a very early time, but then at the same time, you've got the Cultural Revolution under which, you know, men and women are kind of sexless comrades. And it doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. It's all hands on deck, right? All of a sudden, it's like, ladies, we don't need you being so fragile and aloof at home. We actually need you out in our factories and in our fields because we have a very big goal to accomplish and we need every possible body to be able to do it. I mean, that wasn't a women's movement, right? Getting women to work and to be part of the revolution. That wasn't to give greater opportunities to women. It was really just because they were necessary. And that's kind of where you have a distinction with the U.S., right? In the U.S., there's actually been, you know, a real concerted women's-led feminist movement. Whereas in China, a lot of the advances that women have just sort of been a matter of practicality. Like, we need to build a nation, so we need your help. So we're going to require it. But that also backfires, right? It's like, our nation has too many people. We need to curb your fertility, and so we're going to do that. And now, you know, what we've seen as of 2015, our nation doesn't have enough people. We need more babies. Have two children. And I mean, it was actually, it's an invitation to have two children, but the expectation was kind of like, the rather delirious expectation was that every woman who could would have a second child, and that women who hadn't had any would have two. And of course, as we're seeing, that's very different for reasons that I explain in the book, right? Some women aren't even getting married. But it is sort of a very speckled history of moments where you have, you know, women who you would say were very advanced for their time. I mean, you can go back to Wu Zetian, right? A formidable leader and a formidable force in history. And I think if you, it's in there somewhere in the book, but if you like add up what she's worth at the time, the modern equivalent still makes her like the richest, the wealthiest woman of all time. So you have formidable figures like this, but then at the same time, you have, and you know, China, as I say in the book, is also home to the greatest population of female billionaires in the world. But at the same time, you know, it's also a very poor place. There's this duality.
Everything in China is a duality. And I think that's what makes it such an interesting place and an interesting country to study and even to understand. There, you know, there's this dynamic, almost capitalist society going on and this communist. I mean, it's just a
weird, It is.
Exactly. And it's just so strange. I mean, that makes it interesting. But the other thing is that mothers, you know, mothers raise daughters. We all have a mother, right? We all have the same mother, by the way, I think. But I mean, you know, there's always a generational pull. There's always, your mother is always from a different generation from you. Usually, at least in the 20th, 21st century, they're more conservative than you are. You know, they're more reserved. They have expectations for their children and for their daughters in particular. You know, and thou shalt be married. By the way, there's a great quote. I wrote this down. Marriage is like putting a winter coat on your freedom. It makes it harder to move around, but keeps you warm, old Chinese proverb. I really relate to that. It's like a noose around the neck kind of thing. And yet, you know, whether it's biological and, you know, there's that biological clock thing that goes on and it compels you towards, I mean, no matter how liberated women are at some point, you know, there's always that question, should I get married? Do I need to be married? Will society accept me if I'm not married, if I don't have my 2.2 children? You know, those who break those rules are, I think, very unusual people. And within the confines of this book and what you're trying to get across over here, can you address that? Because I know, what did you say? Going home for the holidays was even like, I'm not married. Oh, my God. I'm 25. What do I do?
Yeah, that was a big deal. And that actually comes to a head right now. I mean, right now is Chinese New Year. So there are millions of young Chinese women going home to their parents without any news of a prospective mate. And they're going to be treated, you know, like the characters I describe in the book, like burning buildings. It's like, you know, we're going to celebrate, we're going to eat dumplings, we're going to enjoy these giant spicy fish in, you know, hot pots on our tables, but we're also going to skewer you because you've not come home with any news of a prospective mate. And everyone's together and everyone's talking and extended family is getting together. And so, you know, aunties are going to start suggesting blind dates for you, and you'll likely have to to go on several, maybe even in the course of one day when you're home. Because parents are like, we've got them at home, you know, within our grip. We've got to make the most of the time that we have here for them. And we need to maybe niggle as much as we possibly can to get them to stay, right? Instead of returning to wherever it is they work, in the cases of some of the characters, a bigger city. So that's true. And you know, getting back to your point about this not being just about China, it really is. Like, I think I write in the book that, you know, across the world, in varying degrees, of course, there does exist a pathological scrutiny of a woman who is not married by a certain age. And of course, it's more acute in certain places. So I would say in China, it's pretty acute. In Japan, it's quite acute, although the rates of unmarried women have gone up so much that it's actually become more common. And there are terms for this all over the place. I mean, in China, you have the unsavory term leftover woman, which applies to a woman who has transgressed that socially imposed sell-by date of 27. But in Japan, as I write in the book, it used to be 25. They used to call a woman a Christmas cake. Idea, you know, holiday's over, so's your possibility of ever finding a husband done. Then they upped it, or you're on clearance, as most things are after Christmas. And then they, you know, rather benevolently upped it to 31 and called women New Year's noodles. I mean, this exists in many Latin American countries. It's jamona solterona, a lonely ham, which really puts it out there, you know? So this exists. And I wanted to sort of, I mean, as I said initially, like, My first intent was I really wanted to write this book for Chinese women. I thought it was unfair how defeated they felt for this term, and that it was a misnomer, right? Although they were called leftover, they represented the exact opposite. But I also wanted them to realize, like, first I wanted to do something that would maybe help their parents realize, look, our daughter is not the only single woman in all of China. This is actually a trend. It's becoming more and more common. And we should probably calm down because, you know, the sky is not falling. Our daughters are actually making very important contributions to society, to the economy. And, you know, we should be proud of that. Of course, it's very hard to change that mentality because, you know, a culture's economy can, you know, expand at the speed of light as we saw China's did. But the culture's never going to change as quickly. And it goes back to this idea of, you know, what you were saying earlier about generational differences between mothers. There's always something there. But in China, that difference is especially marked because it's all happened in such a concentrated period of time. And as one of the characters says, you know, it's like a generation of chickens has given birth to a generation of ducks, which actually isn't. I mean, they're not that different of a species. Another one said, you know, modern China is like a giant episode of Sex and the City, except instead of body Samantha, we have our practical Charlotte-like minded mothers, right? And that's really what it is. The moms haven't had time to catch up. And so the opportunities that the moms had are very different from the much greater opportunities that their daughters have. And, you know, for mothers, marriage wasn't discretionary. If you were working in a work unit and you showed up to work without a husband, you're the leader of your work unit could find you one because there was like, marry this guy. There's no single housing, right? So moms, you know, the moms of these women, they didn't get to marry for love. Neither did their fathers. Everything was kind of mercenary and transactional for the good of the nation, right? Mao Zedong said that love was a bourgeois sentiment. He didn't want people distracted on falling in love. He had a nation to build, you know?
Right. Well, you know, I want to interject here because I want to say to you, this thing, this idea of even falling in love is something relatively new to society, you know, to Western society. How did they respond to you? There you are, this single running around in a country, you know, around the world. Adorable, by the way. Cute as a button. You know, very New York, as you said, not afraid to speak to your mind. I mean, everybody was looking at you like, who are you? How were you looked upon
mean my parents, my women, my men?
Well, all right, let's start. My parents. Parents must have thought you were a whore.
My parents. Well, I mean, so a lot of moms, I would spend time with Chinese women and their moms most often, right? And it was usually a lot of fun. I mean, I remember one time I went to a studio recording or a live broadcast. No, it was a recording of this really famous dating show in China called Fei Chang Wu Rao, If You Are the One. It was the top show in China for a long time. And actually, one of the main characters in my book was on the show. This isn't in the book. It actually ended up getting edited out, but she came back from Yale and she was frantic that she didn't have a husband. And so she started She applied to this show to be a contestant because it was widely broadcast all over the country, and she thought rather erroneously that it would help in her mate search. And she got like priority booking because she had a fancy degree. And out of the 12 contestants on the show, they would always reserve female contestants. They would always reserve one spot for a well-educated woman. So she kind of got priority for that. So I went to see a taping of this show with a friend and her mom. And so it's usually like 12 women, I believe, and then men come on. And women are allowed to judge whether or not they're interested in the man. And to this girl's mom, all the men were great. And she would ask my friend, well, what do you think of this one? And my friend would say, Ma, 质量不好. You know, like, Mom, the literal translation is like, the quality is not good. but what she meant was like, Mom, this is not my kind of thing. And so the mom felt like she needed to verify all these claims by me. Like, what do you think? What do you think of this guy? And I'm like, honestly, I really don't think that this break dancer from, you know, or whatever, you know, they were all different profiles, but I really don't think that this is the type of, anyone who's on this show is probably not the type of person that should be dating your daughter anyway. But we had a lot of fun. For me, I think, I don't know, maybe bringing me along to some of these things and having me chat with mom was a way to make them laugh, because I don't know, here you have this foreigner, you know, yapping them to them in her version of Chinese and telling them, you know, like, hey, don't be so hard on your daughter. You know, this guy, let her do this on her own time. Look what she's accomplished. And it alleviates some of the pressure, right? Because obviously girls can't have that same conversation in such a lighthearted way with their own mom, but I could. And if, you know, and sometimes I would take the mom's side. Like if a girl was saying, oh, she's setting me up on so many blind dates, I'm so tired of them. I'm like, hey, you know, you're pretty lucky. Like it's not everyone in the world. Not everyone's mom, you know, presents an endless barrage of men to refuse. This is actually quite special. I tried to make them also appreciative of what their moms did. So I don't know. I didn't really side with moms or daughters. I just tried to, you know, pick up the color of what was going on and make sense of a situation that is very different from, you know, anything I might experience here. When I tell my parents, like, Chinese parents go to parks, and grandparents especially, and they'll, you know, take a cardboard sign that's written in wobbly brush ink, advertising the name and the age and the profession and the blood type and the star sign of their daughters who they have on the market to, you know, for marriage.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh, you know, if my parents had to go to the park and pander me to other parents, like, what the heck would they say? It's just a really funny thing to think about. So yeah. It was really for me. And, you know, you learn so much from the parents. You really do.
There's the last thing that I want to talk about, because there are some aspects of this that you know, become interesting within any society. I mean, we went through the sexual revolution, you know, as a part of this, you know, freedom for women. And at the end of the day, that's a conversation we could have. That's really interesting, where I have this theory that there are a lot of women who were, you know, just having a lot of fun, who have post-traumatic stress disorder. A lot of my friends have talked about that from some of the crazy that, you know, you did in order to liberate yourself and break the rules to find, you know, a better way, a different way, a more modern way. But there's also there, women are, they're not prostitutes. I'm trying to remember the word that how you put it, where they become professional mistresses.
Yeah, this is something that kind of blew my mind. I mean, when I first got to China, it sort of became clear that, and I started to look into relationships and just how important marriage had been for such a long time. It was this kind of universal social imperative for women. And many times it was, as in most parts of the world, as you pointed out earlier, it was a very transactional affair. And a lot of that was just changing now, because suddenly for women, it was more discretionary. It sort of made sense that extramarital activity was so common in China, because if, you know, if people are getting married for transactional reasons, well, maybe they're going to look for love on the side, right? And so, or, you know, extracurricular activity, right? And so I thought it was important to feature the voice of a mistress in the book, because mistresses are also left over. They are defying that pressure to wed. They're not, you know, squeezing themselves into that box of a woman who gets married by a certain age. But it also totally threw my understanding of gender dynamics on its head. I mean, there certainly are mistresses in China who are sort of, I don't know, low-level mistresses, right? They'll keep a man company in exchange for maybe him paying rent on a nice apartment or some handbags or some cash here and there. But then there's a whole other level of mistresses. And actually, I should point out that there are two types of mistresses in China. It's such a common thing. There are actually two varieties. Mm. You can get an arnai, which translates as second breast, or you can get a xiaosan, which translates as a little three. Now, the arnai is the type of mistress that who's the main character in my book. It's the mistress who is not in love with you, but who is using you for material gain. Now, that could be something like rent on an apartment or a car or a handbag or some cash, but it could also be, as I discovered, social capital. So say you have clout in the party or in the world of private finance. And maybe as a woman, and I'm not sure, I really do say maybe as a woman, the gender cards are so stacked against you in the business world that it's just much easier for you to get something done if you have a man kind of backing you, if you have his connections or if you have his capital. And so you become his mistress. And it's not because you need those handbags or you need that car or that apartment. You have those things yourself. What you're after is something of a very different nature. And then you have Xiaosan, who, I mean, researching Xiaosan was so fun because Xiaosan are little three. It means the type of mistress who is actually in love with the man that she's seeing, right? And many times this can actually be painful for the Xiaosan because maybe this man isn't willing to get divorced because he doesn't want to rock the boat or he just doesn't want to bother. He's not in love with this woman, but she's in love with him. And obviously she's in it for somewhat of a monetary arrangement, but the primary reason for it is love. And there's actually a group of Xiaosan who a long time ago, this post has since been taken down, things get censored in China, but they declared that March 3rd was their international holiday because March 3rd is 3-3 and they're known as the little threes, right? And they had a website where they described, you know, it was kind of like a group where they could swap information and give one another advice on how to deal with problems that came up in the relationships that they had with married men. And it really was just such a fascinating way of understanding extramarital activity and really underscored this idea that it's completely warranted. I mean, I was told very frankly by a man who ended up being a very open source about, you know, his mistress activity in China that it is expected in China that once a man hits a certain degree of wealth or status that he have a mistress. It's almost looked down upon if he doesn't. And it's normal for him to show up at a business dinner with his mistress instead of his wife. And in most cases, his wife may know him. And I get into that a little bit more in the book. I mean, it really is something kind of wild. And the difference that you see between two of my main characters. So Ivy, who's a mistress, and June, who is a very upstanding, non-Mona Lisa-esque graduate from Yale, is that, you know, Ivy's willing to be a mistress because she wants the capital. And for June, love is more important. And the idea of a man who cheats on her is something that she finds very unpalatable, and she's not willing to enter a relationship if that's what is likely to happen.
So at the end of the day, you know, I got to cut you off, unfortunately, because we're lost on top. I was going to say at the end of the day, it sounds as if, you know, you have choices in China now that you didn't have before. One from column A, one from column B. I mean, take your pick, baby.
Exactly.
I've been speaking with Roseanne Lake. Her book is Leftover in China, The Women Shaping the World's Next Superpower. For more information on Roseanne and her book, visit roseannelake.com. Thank you so much for tuning in to Talkish, the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show with Hallie Kasser-Jane, a production of Resec LLC. Be sure to tune in to Talkish Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern, when new podcasts are posted at HallieKasserJane.com and available on all your favorite apps. Until next time, this is Hallie Kasser-Jane.